So the text for tonight's talk is a little bit of a different source than I usually have. We had a residential retreat here at Sacramento Insight Meditation at the beginning of September. And the Monday after we got back, ended on a Sunday, the next morning I went downtown. There was a rally at the Capitol. And so this was the conversation I overheard on the light rail train. Husband, your attitude is killing me. Wife, my attitude depends on how you treat me. So we've got a two-way thing going there, right? Where the one is depending on the other and the other is depending on the one. Not a lot of options there. So we can depend on outside circumstances to make us happy. We can depend on someone else's behavior to determine what our attitude is going to be. Or with practice, we can actually learn to take responsibility for our own happiness or unhappiness. Someone asked Sariputta about this. Sariputta was the Buddha's right-hand man. Let's see him right over here. Literally, he's always on the right in those tankas. His name was Venerable Bhumija. Bhumija, arising from his seclusion in the late afternoon, went to Venerable Sariputta. On arrival, he exchanged courteous greetings with him. After an exchange of friendly greetings and courtesies, he sat to one side. As he was sitting there, he said to Venerable Sariputta, "Friend Sariputta, there are some Brahmins and contemplatives, teachers of karma, who declare that pleasure and pain are self-made. There are others that declare that pleasure and pain are other-made." And then the formulation in these is always either or, neither nor, that it's neither. The Blessed One so he asked him, which one's right. And Sariputta says, "The Blessed One, my friend, has said that pleasure and pain are dependently co-arisen. Dependent on what? Dependent on contact." That was the title of tonight's talk. Depends on what? So when we talk about causality in this tradition, the Buddha had kind of two levels of talking about it. The most obvious level is when this occurs, then that. It's a very simple formulation. When the polarized caps melt, sea level rises. It's just a very straightforward linear, when this occurs, then that. But the Buddha wasn't a physicist. He was much more interested in how the human mind works, and specifically why and how we suffer. So he taught a special form of causation called dependent origination. And that's what Sariputta is referring to here, is the way in which pleasure and pain arise, not the first dart of just the physical pain, but actually the kind of pain that we add to that second dart that we add, where we compound our own suffering by taking things personally, or a pleasure that occurs because we're living life in accordance with the way that we want to live, and we've let go a little bit. And these are dependently co-arisen. They follow a natural pattern. You might think of it even as a law. One word for that law is dharma. And they roll out in a certain way. Now, for each of us, they may roll out a little bit different. But based on our background and our previous experiences, our mood on a given day, how well we slept the night before, all of these various conditions will touch and affect either the rapidity or the strength of our reactivity when things occur in our lives, but the overall pattern, when it's sort of seen objectively, and you can step back from it a little bit, rolls out in accordance with what we might think of as a natural law. And the Buddha laid this out quite clearly in a number of places throughout the Pali Canon. And he explained that when any of our six sense doors has an experience, when the eyes see, when the ears hear, when taste encounters food, our taste buds encounter tastes, flavors, any of our six sense doors, including when a thought enters the mind, there's an instantaneous and quite subtle reaction, not willful, but instinctive, of pleasant or unpleasant. That's just how we're wired. It just happens, just quickly. So quickly sometimes that we don't even notice it. And what happens next is that that pleasant will often escalate, if it's not noticed, will escalate into desire, liking, and then into desire, and the unpleasant will escalate into disliking and then into aversion. By the time they've reached desire and aversion, we're suffering. That's the Buddha's definition of suffering, is what are sort of lumped under the term of craving, desire and aversion. So what can we do about that? It is, when we first start to practice with it, it's actually a little bit discouraging because that process is so rapid that before we even notice it, we're all the way to desire and aversion. And then things roll out from there in this process of dependent origination. They go on from there. Because once we've held on and we start to grab things, we hold on even tighter and we say, not only is there an unpleasant feeling arising, but this is my unpleasantness. This is my anger, irritation, frustration, sadness, grief, the whole nine yards of what we might think of as suffering. So at first, just like in meditation, when we first start to meditate, you know, often beginners will say, oh my gosh, this meditation thing is terrible. All of a sudden I have all kinds of thoughts in my mind that I never had before. Well, I mean, in fact, they were there all the time. We just never stopped to notice them. And similarly with this process, we never really stop to notice desire and aversion arising from pleasant and unpleasant. They were escalating into unskillful speech and behavior all the way to that level of suffering, and we would be blurting things out or doing unskillful behaviors without even noticing the process. What this practice gives us the opportunity to do is actually bring some awareness to that process to the point where it actually slows it down a little bit. So we talk about practice. There are three times to practice: before, during, and after. In other words, you can practice at any time. And at first, we need to practice after a lot. We need to actually feel the unpleasantness of saying something that we really didn't want to say to a loved one and feeling the hurt of that, either feeling it when we say it or having it reflected back to us in their face, in their body language, in their subsequent behavior. And, you know, even though that experience of feeling the consequences of our unskillful actions is really, really unpleasant, it's a gift. It's a feedback that we can then use to say, I don't want that to happen anymore. I do not want to cause that kind of pain to the people around me. I'm going to do things differently in the future. And then once we actually have access to these teachings that explain quite clearly how the process rolls out, then we can start bringing awareness while we're saying things. And then we can start bringing awareness before we say something unskillful. We can bring awareness to the thought that is driving that speech or behavior. And with practice, we can eventually notice the arising of intention that causes us to have those thoughts, that causes us to say those words. So essentially with time, we gradually begin to develop the ability to slow the whole process down and move ourselves from after to during to before. What happens then is really important. We start to notice that as we actually speak unskillfully less and less often and less quickly, we start to suffer less. And the people around us start to suffer less, but then we start to suffer less. And the feedback of that is happiness. Ajahn Amaro describes it this way in a book called Small Boat, Great Mountain. The untrained heart chases the delightful, runs away from the painful, and as a result finds itself struggling, alienated, and miserable. By contemplating our own experience, we can make a clear distinction between the mind that knows and the sense impressions that flow through it. By refusing to get entangled with any sense impressions, we find refuge in that quality of stillness, silence, and spaciousness, which is the mind's own nature. This policy of non-interference allows everything and is disturbed by nothing. Allows everything and is disturbed by nothing. So Ajahn Amaro is pointing to the possibility that we could accept whatever experiences happen to us in our lives, you know, whether that's a noisy train in the middle of our meditation or, you know, a loud leaf blower when we're trying to have a conversation on the phone, whatever it might be, and be okay with that. We don't have to have pleasant experience to be content. What a wonderful possibility. Sayadaw Tejaniya puts it like this: with thought, we can investigate the mind. If thoughts are known, then we are capable of knowing what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. Or another way of putting that is what is skillful, what is unskillful. If we know this, then we can use wisdom to make wholesome choices in our lives. When we live a wholesome life, things tend to fall into place. Dhamma is working for us. It makes us happiness. It makes us happy, a happiness born of wisdom. So you can almost hear the conditionality that he's pointing out there. And this is not the rolling on towards suffering of dependent origination. This is sort of rolling back the other way. So he says, with thoughts we can investigate the mind. In other words, actually notice when these unskillful intentions are arising. Actually noticing when the thoughts that are driving some of our bad habits that have been with us for years are running. Notice the emotions that are connected with that particular train of thought that drive them and make them stronger, that make them easier to believe, that make them personal. Not anger is arising, but I'm an angry person. That's the kind of thing we can actually start to investigate. If thoughts are known, then we are capable of knowing what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. If we know this, then we can use wisdom to make wholesome choices in our lives. When we live a wholesome life, things tend to fall into place. I love that. he makes it sound like it's just random chance, right? Things tend to fall into place. You know, you've probably all heard the thing about luck comes to those who are best prepared. And I think that's what he's saying here. Things tend to fall into place when you've spent the time in your practice to actually watch the process of thoughts in your mind, to watch what comes out of making those unwholesome choices, watch the pain and the suffering that occurs from that, and to actually take that seriously. There's a couple of characteristics that, when they were translated by Christian clerics, sound really bad in English, but I haven't heard too many other useful translations. In Pali, they're called Hiri and Otapa, and they're called the two guardians of the world. And the translations, and I'll explain a little bit immediately afterwards, so don't get too freaked out by that. Don't let it trigger your reactivity too badly if you were brought up in a Christian tradition like me that feels like these words are really negative. They're shame and what's otapa?
I thought it was remorse.
Remorse and shame, right. So what it really is that these two qualities, one of them is actually, that's the one that's translated as shame, is actually understanding what harm we've caused to ourselves. Knowing that what we've done is unskillful and that we've caused harm to ourselves and others. And this is not guilt. This is not beating ourselves up because we're a bad person or anything like that. What this is about is actually setting the intention to be aware and do better in the future. And then the other one is the quality of knowing what is wholesome and unwholesome, and it's based on the opinion of others. It's actually there's a line in the Metta Sutta where it says, a person would never do what the wise would later reprove. That's that quality of not wanting to do things that the wise would later reprove. So even though they're translated as remorse and shame, it's actually practicing internally and externally, knowing within ourselves what unskillful behavior feels like and setting an intention to do better in the future, and then knowing from our association with skillful people or our association with skillful teachers that something is unwholesome and not wanting to do it because we know from others that it's not skillful. So knowing internally and externally that something is skillful or not skillful. So we need to make sure that we don't allow the inner critic to drown out the sound of wisdom. Because often before we can activate this process of learning from our mistakes, this whole practice is learning from our mistakes. It's all trial and error, but often what happens is that our old patterns of guilt and of beating ourselves up, of feeling like, oh, I'm a bad person because I just did a bad thing, all of these can sort of either arise more quickly because they are old established habits, or they can overpower the incipient wisdom that we're just beginning to develop in our practice, and that maybe we haven't quite developed confidence in. In this practice, faith is not believing something that is impossible to believe with the rational mind. Faith is actually, how did Amaro put it? By contemplating our own experience. Faith in this practice is actually looking at our own experience and learning from it. And knowing, when I've been able to catch myself before I said that unskillful thing, I've actually been able to avoid hurting others and I've felt really good within myself. So to be able to use that, and then faith builds confidence, further confidence. So confidence builds confidence. And then as we practice in this way, we gradually build up a resource that we can go back to as we heard here, as a refuge. We find refuge in that quality of stillness, silence, and spaciousness. We also can find refuge in this collection that we gradually put together of positive experiences, of actually acting skillfully, of actually, in the beginning, refraining from unskillful behavior. But as we practice more and more often, engaging in skillful behavior, as we learn to refrain, then what emerges is the natural qualities of the heart toward generosity, toward understanding, toward patience, all of those paramis that we need to learn to perfect before we can really achieve happiness. Truthfulness, determination, you know, that quality that, boy, I've fallen down 3 times, but I'm just going to get up and keep walking. Resolution, that ability to actually set an intention and stay with it, even when times get tough. So all of these qualities, and faith itself, all of these qualities reinforce each other. And then when we start actually refraining from unskillful behavior, then the ability to act skillfully emerges. And as we act skillfully, we build this reservoir of experiences that we can then go back to as a refuge. Can actually remember, I think you've probably all heard the Buddha's quote about generosity, that if people really understood the benefits of generosity, they would not let a single meal go by without sharing. And he said that generosity brings happiness 3 times. It brings happiness in contemplating the act of giving, brings happiness during the act of giving, and it brings happiness again when we reflect on it. Well, that's true of any of these other qualities. When we act with loving kindness, it's one of the other paramis, metta. When we act with loving kindness in preparing to act in a kind way, we can feel happiness. In the actual act of being kind, I think we all know that feeling of how that feels really good. And then if we reflect back on it, we can feel happiness. I think this is the step that we often forget. You know, many people will say to us, well, you know, Buddhism is so depressing. I mean, all you ever talk about is suffering, or, you know, preparing for your death and all of this stuff. And it's kind of funny. Several of us lately have been taking this goofy online quiz where you choose your, you know, which emoji are you? And myself and my wife and several of our other Buddhist friends are all coming up with the worry wart. What? Worry wart? That wasn't even one of the ones they showed us when they were trying to entice us to take the quiz. You know, all the ones that they were trying to entice us when they took the quiz were all happy and joyful looking. And we're ending up with worry wart. Well, I mean, you know, we do have the courage to face life's difficulties in this practice, but we also need to take time to reflect on positivity, on times when we have been skillful, on times when others have been kind to us. Really need to. This practice is not about completely shutting out positive experiences in our life. What it's about is it's about not causing suffering in our life by grabbing onto the pleasant and thinking that that's the only way we can be happy. Truly, what this whole talk is about. It's understanding that everything happens due to causes and conditions. It's not personal, you know, and we have some control over what kind of mood we're going to have when we arrive somewhere. We can let the lack of parking rule our lives, or we can just go with it and take what's given and find the parking spot when the parking spot shows up and accept that's just the way things are. It's not about me. You know, this is just the way things are today. and then, you know, arrive in the hall with some degree of calm and equanimity. Several of us earlier this week attended a memorial service for Roseanne de Fleming. And I think many of you that have been around a little bit remember her as the coordinator for the St. John's program when we cook and serve dinner once a month. And she just had this wonderful, peaceful quality about her. And after that service, several of us were talking, and someone mentioned that after Diane did this beautiful service, and after she did her part of it, she and Victor, Roseanne's husband, opened the mic to anyone from the gathering that wanted to speak, and a lot of people spoke. And in fact, a lot of people spoke in sign language, because Roseanne was a daughter of deaf parents and had a deaf brother, and her life was dedicated to bettering the lives of deaf and hard of hearing folks. So the sharing to a person was really heartfelt and really, really deep. And someone mentioned, we were just talking, and they said, you know, did you notice how every person, there wasn't a single person that spoke here that was being superficial. They were all really speaking from the heart and really speaking deeply. And we both agreed that that's because Roseanne was the way she was. She had this very quiet presence about her, and that, you know, drew people to her, but she was very kind of quiet about herself as well. And yet, you know, the people that she ended up drawing around her were people that, like her, were very thoughtful. And so the fact that this service, this was not planned. This was an open mic when anyone that was there was invited to come up and say whatever they wanted to say. And yet, because she was the way she was, she attracted people who were the way that people were at this service. And I think that is a model for how we can all live our own lives. I mean, to know that our actions have consequences, and that even at that level of the way that we are and the way that we act determines who we gather around us. That thought, and it's true during life as well, that the way that we are and the way that we act determines really who we gather around us. And it also determines when we don't get what we want, whether that's going to knock us off balance or not. So that was a real inspiration, and I think another really good illustration of the workings of cause and effect. Several folks in this community are taking a year-long class with Dennis Warren on How Can I Help? And the other book that they're using, How Can I Help? Is a book by Ram Dass. And the other book they're using is Joanna Macy's World is Love or World is Self. That entire book is based on her doctoral dissertation on dependent origination. And when she first came to Buddhism, she thought of dependent origination as this dry, cold, sort of overly analytical process. But the more that she studied it, the more she realized that it was essential, not only essential to Buddhist teachings, but it was one of those teachings that was really unique to Buddhism, as opposed to some of the other traditions that were going around at the time. And Joanna has this lovely summary of dependent origination, which in this quote she calls mutual causality, meaning that in dependent origination, everything is conditioned by what precedes it, but then everything also conditions what's after it. So the causation works both ways. All the factors of our lives subsist in a web of mutual causality. Our suffering is caused by the interplay of these factors, and particularly by the delusion, aversion, and clinging to what is by nature contingent and transient. Being caused in this way, our suffering is not endemic. It can cease. The causal play can be reversed. This is achieved by seeing the true nature of phenomena, which is their radical interdependence. This is made possible by the cleansing of perception through meditation and moral conduct. So those of you that are studying the Noble Eightfold Path will recognize in those last two of the three trainings of the Noble Eightfold Path, right? Moral conduct is the training in sila, and meditation is the training in bhavana, and then what she doesn't name in that sentence is the training in wisdom, which is the entire paragraph is about the training in wisdom. So, you know, that's really the hope of this practice. Because of causation, things roll out the way they do. But it also means that there's the possibility that things can change. If things had this inherent, solid meaning, unalterable essence, then we wouldn't be able to change. Our old habits would last forever. There wouldn't be any point in practicing. There wouldn't be any point in awareness. Why should you pay attention to something that's going to be the same in the next moment, and the same in the next moment after that? There's no point, besides which you get bored really fast. So I just love her point here about being caused in this way, our suffering is not endemic, it can cease. The causal play can be reversed. I also love the way she uses the word play in here twice. You know, causal play can be reversed, and she says our suffering is caused by the interplay of these factors, you know. Did any of you catch the Nobel Prize in Physics earlier this week? It was mind-bending. So a Nobel Prize in Physics was given to these people that study the states of matter, and the way the newspaper described it was the strange states of matter. So the first thing, the one that caught my eye, was that the coffee cup in their system is equivalent to a donut. Because they study topology, and topology looks at how many holes there are in things. So a coffee cup, you know, with its handle and then the cup has a single hole, whereas the donut has a single hole. So they're equivalent because the hole on the inside of the cup doesn't go all the way through. The coffee cup and the donut are the same in their view. So this led them to some radical experiments where they took three-dimensional objects in the real world, although at the microscopic level. They took three-dimensional objects down to two dimensions, actually created two-dimensional objects by making a one-molecule thick layer of something. So they made something so extremely thin that, in essence, it lost its thickness. Okay, it's so thin that it became a two-dimensional object. Well, so what? I mean, who cares? What happened was that in that state, matter underwent what they termed a phase transition. So, you know, in this practice, we talk about how things do not have some kind of an eternal essence. There's this quality of anatta, which means that all phenomena us, the things we observe, everything, not only is impermanent, but it's impermanent in a very specific way. It does not have a permanent essence. It does not have a soul that's going to last forever. All things are in flux and in change. And so, again, just as I was saying earlier, that's what actually gives us the hope in practice, is that there's the possibility of change because we don't have this immutable, unchanging essence. But the change can be so radical that we can have insights about ourselves that are just complete surprises. In fact, my new word for insight is a surprise, because if something comes to you as an insight and it doesn't surprise you, then it's not an insight, right? I mean, you could have reached that conclusion with your logical mind, but this intuitive insight that just arises from doing the practice and letting it unroll and not having any expectations, and then poof, wow, I never understood that possibility for myself. Well, what happens? That's a phase transition. What this materials did when they brought them down from three dimensions to two, all of a sudden, they developed superpowers. They developed superconductivity. So you've probably heard that, you know, that matter can become superconductive and have almost no resistance for electricity passing through it, and that has been used in the real world now to create products. This discovery was made in the 70s. But it's been applied now to where they put on really thin layers of thing that can be extremely conductive. This thing has undergone a phase transition. It's taken on a property that it never had before, that it was physically incapable of having before, because it was reduced. It's all the same molecules. They're all the same molecules. There's no change to the physical makeup. But when its topology was reduced to a single layer, it went from three dimensions to two. All of a sudden, it developed this power that it never had before, power of superconductivity. And it seems to me that that's a good metaphor for the way this practice works. Maybe not superpowers, that might be going a little bit far, although you'll read descriptions of those in the suttas. But we can achieve states of mind. We can achieve levels of commitment. We can achieve a dedication to face difficulty in our lives that we may have thought at the beginning were absolutely not possible. That's not me. I'm not that kind of person. I'm an angry person, or I'm a sad person, or I'm a depressed person, or I'm whatever. We think of that as being our essence, and what we come to find, if we can maintain this practice and let go into it, is that the possibilities are surprising. These scientists were all very surprised when this single molecular layer of matter took on the properties of superconductivity. That they weren't expecting that at all. They had no idea. So similarly, in our practice, we don't have to go into it with any kind of expectation of what we're going to achieve. All we have to do is do the practice and be open to the phase transition when it occurs. And understanding this process of cause and effect, of conditionality, is a really great way to go about that. Not only in our formal meditation practice, but in daily life. This is very applicable in daily life. Sayadaw Tejaniya says, "In daily life, our attention is usually only drawn to the result of our actions when we are suffering. Why is this happening to me? When life is good and we are happy, we are normally only lightly aware. We notice it as a good moment, but our main focus is on the next moment to keep it going. This is greed. Keep that pleasantness going. This is greed. With this practice of vipassana, of seeing clearly, I'm asking you to look at every moment, both good and bad, with an overall awareness of what is happening at all the sense doors in that moment. Look at the reaction in your mind to what is happening and investigate. Ask the question, why is this happening? Why? You notice he leaves out the "to me" in the second version of it. Why is this happening? We need to know and then understand. So know just means to be aware of, but then understand the overall cause and effect relationship of what is happening. Then we can find meaning and bring more lasting happiness into our lives. This is wisdom at work. So that's the hope of the practice. Comments, questions, experiences?
Well, you know, sometimes, you know, watching my feelings, and it doesn't seem like my thoughts are really, you know, like I'm just thinking of something, and then, but I feel more emotion than what the thought is really doing. It's really hard to know sometimes where these, you know, I mean, sometimes it feels like the feelings are operating independent of thoughts.
Right.
It's just, here's this feeling.
Yeah.
And maybe the feeling even came first before the thought.
I think so. Yeah, no. The mind has an amazing ability to just generate randomness. So I would trust the emotion and work with that more than the accompanying thoughts when they're not lining up or they're not feeding each other. Because that's absolutely right. It's hard to fake an emotion. But our minds can just spew out. I mean, we've all seen it. Anybody that's done meditation for any amount of time at all has seen how the mind can just generate a bunch of random thoughts that seem to make no sense at all. So I think it's, you know, this is a body-based practice, and so often an emotion will express itself somewhere in the body and give us actually something to work with, where the thoughts often are just so fleeting that they're just sort of going by, and there's really not even anything to hold on to or to work with. So I would, first of all, that observation that the thoughts are not linked to the emotions is a really valuable insight. Lots of times I think we assume that, well, yeah, you know, the thoughts must be directly associated with this emotion, and often they do reinforce the emotion. You know, emotion will bring up a certain kind of thinking that will reinforce the emotion. So that can happen, but just that noticing, oh, these thoughts are just random, they aren't with the emotion at all, but the emotion probably feels more real.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's where I would go with the attention, is into the emotion, to where it's expressed in the body, and then just let the thoughts fade off into the background. Yeah, don't try to make sense of it, because it may not be making any sense.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm having trouble understanding the teaching that we can eventually get to the point where suffering ceases when you have these very painful, hurtful experiences. And it seems counterintuitive to, or if we take it, the teaching to the extreme, that it's like we're taught that our happiness or our lack of suffering is completely independent of outside, of what's happening outside, which seems unrealistic. It's like someone's being abused or there's constant harm being inflicted on someone, either you know, emotionally or physically.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm having trouble understanding, putting the teaching and that concept together.
Okay. Yeah. Right. So this is not about being passive in the face of injustice or anything like that. But what the teaching is that when faced with that, we can actually maintain some kind of balance. Now, the action in the outside world may be to oppose that injustice or to remove that child from the situation that they're in or to take some kind of active role, but we're doing it with a balance of mind that isn't based on anger, that isn't based on being out of balance. We're actually going into that action with some kind of understanding of our own emotion in that moment and with compassion for the other parties. So this isn't at all about downplaying or minimizing the existence of evil in the world or the existence of injustices that need to be addressed. What this is about is developing the ability to be calm in the midst of chaos. The Zen hospice, Franco Stiseski calls it, you know, calm in the midst of chaos, his work in hospice work. To actually be able to have this that refuge of stillness that Ajahn Amaro talked about in the midst of taking on things like that. I mean, Joanna Macy took this understanding of dependent origination and her life work was going into places like Chernobyl where these incredible ecological disasters occurred and being right there with the people who had suffered that and being a presence for them. I mean, her entire life has been dedicated to achieving justice in the world. So it's not at all about accepting injustice and allowing that to occur. It's about achieving some kind of balance in our mind so that we can actually address injustice skillfully.
I don't have a problem understanding that. That seems very clear to me.
Okay.
I guess my problem is relating to myself.
Okay.
I'm in a situation where it feels like someone is treating me unfairly, treating me oppressively, and I want to just get away from that.
Yeah, yeah.
But that seems. But then we're taught not to run away from aversion or cling towards the pleasure, and I'm having trouble understanding how to put that into practice.
Yeah. Well, no, this practice would not advocate staying in a dangerous situation, I mean, either emotionally or physically dangerous. Where you would work with the aversion would be after you've extracted yourself from that situation, you're going to be left with some residual of that in your mind, right? So you've gotten your mind and your body to a safe space, but that suffering is going to continue because of the residual from that experience. That's where the work begins in this practice. Well, it doesn't begin. I mean, the fact that you had a presence of mind to extract yourself from that situation in the first place is not a form of aversion. You know, that's a form of skillful means of dealing with a current situation in the real world. But where this practice applies is in that habit that we've all had of adding the second arrow of self-judgment or of hatred or of holding on in some way to that original negative experience, to physical pain or to oppression or to abuse, anything like that, to take that and then we add to it. And that's what we're trying to address. So one of the best illustrations I've heard of this was not by a Buddhist teacher, but it was from a self-help book called How to Want What You Have. And in that book, this is an attorney from Stockton that wrote this book named Miller. In that book, he talks about two people who have the same experience, a broken ankle. So the physical pain is going to be exactly the same in these two stories. So in the first story, a person's at a company picnic, and they're playing softball, and he hits a ball to the outfield, and he runs the bases, and he slides into home and breaks his ankle. And all of his friends are standing around him and cheering him, and the ambulance comes and carts him off to the hospital, and he's lying in the hospital with a broken ankle and feeling this, sure, physical pain, but feeling the warmth of all of the people that gathered around him in that situation. The other situation is someone whose brother-in-law is moving, and he's sort of dreading having to help, and finally the call comes, okay, I'm ready, we're going to move that cabinet down the stairs, goes over to his brother-in-law's house, starts moving the cabinet down the stairs, slips, breaks his ankle, you know, the ambulance comes, takes him to the hospital. Well, he went into the situation with a bunch of resentment, and that's what's coloring his experience of the pain. So he actually may be feeling more physical pain than the person in the first place, even though they have the same physical injury. I think that's a good example of the difference between pain and suffering. So yeah, let's be careful not to confuse a skillful means in removing either ourselves or other people from a really bad situation, confusing that with aversion. We need to turn toward our mental attitudes toward adverse situations, but there's certainly still a place for removing ourselves either physically or emotionally from damaging situations. Thank you for that question.
Thank you for the answer.
Anything else? Okay. Sabitri, who's running our website now, posted this poem by Dennis Warren this week. And I hadn't read it in a while, but I think it really applies to tonight. Would make a nice summary. It's called The Vow. At some point, he realized he had to make a choice, or his weaknesses and his fears would dominate him for the rest of his life. The pain of being aware, of seeing the consequences of not choosing, had become more painful than continuing to give in. So he made a vow, not about the future, but about what he would do now, in this moment, over and over again. So thank you for your kind attention, and may whatever positive energy came up for you tonight or in the future as you reflect on tonight, may it serve to minimize and prevent suffering for all beings.